Our special guest tonight, Edward Humes. His book is called Burned. We'll be back and talk with him more about this Joanne Parks case and some other evidence that's out there. And we'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Edward Humes with us, his book, Burned. And Edward, where do people get the book, by the way, because it is a very nice read?
Oh, bookstores, online, and brick and mortar, anywhere.
Okay, it's all over the place. Okay, back to some of this evidence that got Joanne Parks convicted. Do the prosecutors ever get to a point where they say, there's something wrong here, but we still got a prosecutor and we'll go after her? I mean, do they have any feelings about the cases that they handle?
Well, it specifically in the Parks case, they determined that they felt she belongs in prison still. And they found some experts who say, oh, well, yeah, flashover occurred, but we still think it was arson. And then there's other experts who said, no, you can't, there's no scientific way to say that now. So that was the dispute. There are other cases, excuse me, innocence cases in which prosecutors will join with the defense attorneys to say, yes, this was an injustice. And you know, together march into court and say, let's let this person go. That does happen.
If they open up the case again and she gets out, will the state owe her a lot of money?
You know, that varies from state to state and from case to case. In general, there's not a whole lot of compensation available for people in her situation.
Right.
Sometimes, when there's egregious misconduct, you know, when the it's not just the they get it wrong, but they actually hide evidence or lie about it, then there have been some really huge verdicts for people who've been wrongly accused. But this isn't one of those cases where there's misconduct by the authorities. This is the Parks case is one in which the allegation is that people were acting in good faith, but got it wrong.
Have any of those experts who testified against her in the original trial, have they looked at the new science and said, I could be wrong?
No, they don't say that. And that is one of the sticking points. That's why there's a disagreement, because there have been other forensic cases in which the experts have come back and said, I messed up. That is not, they're sticking by their guns in the Parks case. And that it was very hotly disputed in court as to who's right about that. You know, there is some of these forensic cases where it has gone wrong show that some of the absurdities in the law. In fact, the case that led to a change in the law in California that made it possible for Parks to challenge her conviction at all involved a guy named Bill Richards. And he was convicted on the basis of forensic dentistry, you know, that comparing a bite mark on somebody's and a victim's skin to his crooked teeth.
It was perfect match, they said, right?
Yeah. Well, Bill Richards was accused of murdering his wife, and they lived in the Mojave Desert area. And there was two hung juries that wouldn't convict him, and the majority felt that he was innocent. But the prosecutors in San Bernardino County kept trying him. And the third time was the charm for them because they found a dentist, this guy, Skip Sperber, who claimed that he could match with certainty the mark on the victim's hand with Richards's teeth. And that was enough to finally convict him. So he goes to prison for 22 years on the basis of that testimony. Meanwhile, the Innocence Project goes in and finds and petitions the court to test DNA that was found on the murder weapon, and they find that it does not belong to either the victim or Bill Richards, that somebody else was there and handled the murder weapon.
Almost like The Fugitive, the movie, huh?
Yes, exactly. And so with that evidence in hand, the Sperber, the dentist expert, comes forward and says, you know what, this, my my testimony was wrong. There's no science behind it. I don't know who or what that mark is. And the prosecution on the case refused to concede that the prosecution was unjust. Instead, they argued a technicality. They said, well, under California law, you can't say expert testimony is false because it's an opinion. It's not factual testimony. It's just an opinion. It can be wrong, but it can't be false. And if it's not false evidence, then he still had a fair trial, even though the outcome was wrong. And they kept him in prison for 8 more years with that argument until the California state legislature finally said, this is really not good. This is a miscarriage of justice. And they changed the law so that expert testimony could also be false testimony when it was wrong, when the expert recanted it, as they did in this case. And finally, after 22 years, almost half of which we knew he was innocent the whole time he was in prison, Bill Richards finally walked out. And it was the change in that law that allowed Joanne Parks to challenge the expert testimony as false testimony in her case.
Does she expect to get released eventually and win and be vindicated?
Well, she lost her first decision so far by the trial court, and now it's going before the Court of Appeals. And the Innocence Project is trying to recreate the fire. They're trying to raise the funds to restage the fire as it happened. Because their experts say that if we can do that, we can show that the government's theory in the case can't possibly be true. So that's where the case stands right now.
Does she show any emotion at all, Edward?
It's very hard for her to talk about her children. She usually bursts into tears, and they showed very graphic
photographs
of the children, the burns on the children in the courtroom, both at her original trial and at the recent hearing. And the judge excused her from the courtroom because of her reaction to that. Even after all these years, it's very difficult for her. At least that's
crunching.
The outward emotion she displays. Of course, the prosecution says she's faking it, that she's and it's crocodile tears. The thing is, they could never come up with a realistic motive for why she would do this, because the interesting thing, there had been a fire in their previous apartment, which they lost all their possessions, but nothing, nobody was hurt. And it had been ruled an accident by the same arson investigator who investigated the second fire. And you would think if someone was planning to set a fire that, after that first fire, in which there was no fire insurance, that they would buy insurance for the second time if they were setting fire deliberately. But there was no insurance, and so they lost everything again, including the lives of their children. So it was hard to argue that there was a financial motive for doing it because there was no insurance. So it was baffling.
There was a story that I was thinking of using before you came on as a lead-in to you, but it was so morbid I didn't even want to use it. But three little kids in Florida jumped inside of a little freezer that was outside, closed the lid, and they couldn't get out. They all suffocated. And, there were two people in the house at the time, and they were looking for the kids. They couldn't find them. But nobody thought, there's a freezer outside that had just been delivered. Let's look in there. And the kids were in there. But what a hood out.
That kind of tragedy really led to a different way of manufacturing. The latches on refrigerators and freezers, they're supposed to be just magnetic so they can...
This looks like an old one, but the kids were little, 1, 4, and 6, almost like Joanne Parks' kids.
Yeah, what a terrible tragedy.
They couldn't get out. But, I mean, is somebody going to get nailed on manslaughter charges or who knows what?
Yeah, it's hard to see a criminal act in that, as opposed to deliberately setting a fire to burn down the house. It's clear cut if that's what happened. But
was there any insurance money here?
No, that's what I was saying. There's no motive for that. There was no insurance money, and the house was not insured, and the children were not insured. The government tried to suggest that, well, but they were planning to sue the landlords afterwards, and that was their financial motive. But, that's it's a far cry from deciding after the tragedy to sue somebody versus the you know, getting an insurance policy before the fire.
Did she?
That might have, you could argue, was suspicious, but that didn't happen.
Did she have family, and did they stand by her?
No, she had been estranged from her mother and sisters, and that continued after the fire. She really has had no one. She has a surrogate family of, actually, the fire expert from her original trial, who was really ahead of his time, and he believed flashover had occurred, and the prosecutor in the case made him sound like a quack, but it turned out he was right all those years ago. And he tried to point out what he thought were the flaws in the investigation. And he was a former Los Angeles City Fire Department fire captain, and had been a firefighter for many years, and then he entered the private sector as a fire expert. So he was no, you know, sort of pro-defense kind of guy. He fought fires and made arson arrests himself for many years. So he was convinced he was innocent. And after he retired, he spent his own money and time and years trying to champion her release. And he's the one who got the Innocence Project involved. He's since passed away, but his daughters have become close to Joanne Parks and have offered to give her a place to live if she's ever released until she gets on her feet again. So they visit her and stay in touch with her and have become like a family to her.
Not that it's a fail-safe, but has she ever taken a polygraph test? I would love to see what the results might be on something like that.
No, she has not, and it probably wouldn't be persuasive to the authorities, I don't think. But no, as far as I know, that has never been considered.
You don't think if she took it and passed it, the authorities wouldn't say, with this and the new evidence, maybe she is innocent?
Honestly, no, I don't think.
Really?
Huh.
No. All right, let's take some calls here for you, and we'll take calls after the break as well. Mike in Cleveland, Ohio is with us. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Edward.
Hi there.
Edward, I had a question for you. There was someone that I knew that was issued a warrant for a DNA sample that had a 10-point familial DNA match. They got a warrant for him, and then 45 days later, they exonerated him. But in the meantime, it ruined him and it ruined his business because it leaked out. There was a high-profile case about a young girl's murder. How do you feel about that, and how do you feel about possibly raising, I know there's a 20-point match for a DNA match, but for African Americans and Latinos, do you think that's a high enough match, or should they go to, say, a 30-point match to actually confirm that, you know, this person is actually guilty? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Interesting question, Edward.
Well, it is interesting, and I am not. The terminology I have seen used in courtroom comparisons of DNA between a suspect and crime scene evidence isn't expressed in terms of points the way a fingerprint would be. That sounds like a fingerprint comparison. The way it's usually expressed, in my experience, and you know, if this is something new that's going on that Michael's describing, I'm not familiar with it, but what they'll do is say, we have a partial DNA sample from a crime scene, and there is a 1 in 3 million probability, or 1 in 200,000, or some kind of odds like that, of this matching the defendant's DNA. And so it'll be expressed in terms of a probability of a match versus, you know, this 5 or 10 point comparison. I'm not sure what that means. So when it gets to the point of being used in the courtroom, either to exonerate somebody or to, in which case it'll be exclude that person from being the guilty party, or to, if it includes them, they'll express it in terms of the probability of it being somebody else's DNA. And usually it's a very small probability that it could belong to somebody else. When it's not that improbable, they usually don't use that as DNA as the main piece of evidence.
Edward, when you were interviewing Joanne Parks, it's only human nature, even though you're a journalist, to, you know, kind of look at her and make up your own mind just by seeing if you could see anything, any signs or anything like that. In this particular case, when you were with her, did you see anything that made you uncomfortable?
She was very consistent in the story that she told in terms of my interviews with her. One of the things that really hurt her at her original trial was that her initial story to the police matched the evidence. She said, well, I opened the door, I couldn't get through the fire, and I ran for help. And basically, that explained why she had no burns and no smell of smoke on her when she came out. But that night, her husband came from work to the police station, and the first thing he did was say, you killed the kids. You did nothing to save them. And she was, like, mortified. And after that, she started saying that she did a little more to try and save
them. I see.
Changed her story.
She felt guilty.
Well, that's the ambiguity in this case. Yeah. The police say, well, she can't tell a straight story. She must be guilty. And her lawyer says, yeah, no, she felt guilty because she didn't save her kids, and her husband accused her of not doing enough, so she fibbed and made it sound like she tried a little harder. Now, is that what we want to hear about someone's behavior? No, it's not an admirable thing to tell the truth, but whether or not that proves that she's guilty is a whole other question.
I wonder how many people...
She told a very consistent story to me.
I wonder how many people would run in there with the place engulfed in flames. You know, would you put a blanket over yourself? What I wonder how many people would react like that.
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Nobody knows how they'll react in that situation when
as horrible as it is
when you face it. I will say that some of the jurors bought the argument that she, should have done more. And that, you know, a mother, you know, the jurors came out and say a mother would just die rather than let her children.
Well, she should have done more. Maybe she should have died in the fire trying to protect them. But that doesn't mean she killed them.
Exactly. But those are the, I mean, that's what.
And she's got to live with that for the rest of her life, by the way.
She does. And she feels, she says she feels tremendous guilt about it. And it seems like that's, may be the case. The emotions seem genuine, but again, I wasn't there. I didn't witness it. So, you asked me before. Well, I don't express an opinion in the book whether she's guilty or innocent. But do I think there's legitimate questions about the quality of evidence in the case that convicted her? I do. I mean, and it certainly deserves the kind of scrutiny it's receiving now.
Absolutely. Were you able to talk to any jurors, or were they not known to anybody?
I was able to speak to one of the jurors. Quite a few of them are no longer, the trial was in 1991, and a number of the jurors have passed away, but I was able to locate one and talk to him about it. And he, actually, he was a retired firefighter, and had been an active firefighter at the time he was on the jury, which surprised me a little bit. But
he should have been disqualified. But
he was not.
Edward, hold on. We're at a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more and take final calls in a moment. Next hour, the incredible story, Miracle in the Cave, about the 12 lost boys, their coach, and the heroes who rescued them in Thailand. It's an amazing story. We'll be back in a moment with Edward Humes and take final phone calls as we talk about his work called Burned. And welcome back, Edward Humes with us. So they had a juror who was a firefighter, and they should have kicked him off, but I guess they didn't, huh?
No, I guess they felt he could be fair, and he told me that some of the jurors were persuaded more about the sort of personal attack on Joanne Parks' character, and that other jurors were persuaded that the government's arson expert was more credible than the defense expert. But of course, we now know that the the government's expert was wrong in his conclusion that flashover did not occur. So.
And in the firefighter's case, did he tell you how he voted?
He explained that the that they felt that the husband was involved, but that they couldn't, there was no proof behind that, that they didn't think she acted alone. And that was one of the main reasons why they did not impose the death penalty, because they felt it was unfair that she should be punished that way while the husband got all, in their opinion, got away with murder.
That's an interesting case. Is he still alive?
No, he passed away.
The husband or the juror?
Yes, the husband.
The husband passed away.
Yes.
How old was he?
He was, well, that's another part of the story. So he met Joanne when she was 17, and he was twice her age.
Jeez.
And seduced her and married her. She lied about her age to him, though, and claimed she was 18 so that she could legally marry him. She ran away from home.
Interesting take. Scott in San Luis Obispo in California. Hey, Scotty.
Hello, George, again. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Hello, Edward. You know, I didn't hear you talk anything about people being falsely accused is restitution. Now, we have 24 states that will not pay you restitution at all. 36 states will pay you some restitution or some decent restitution, depending which state you are in. But can you imagine if you're locked up 10 to 20 years and you've got nothing but the pants and the shoes and the cell phone that you had to recuse, and you're locked up for that long, and you've got no family, or you were either in college and you had to quit college because you were in prison being falsely accused? That to me is 24 states. Why don't they have restitution for people that are locked up? DA admits that they wrongly accused you and they drop charges, that you're just supposed to go free and enjoy, you know, wherever you started from.
We talked a little bit about that, Scott, earlier, and in this particular case, we don't think she'll get much money, Edward, do we?
It's hard to say, but the main point I think Scott is making is true, that it's really quite scandalous that there's no uniform policy. If you go to a conference of exonerees or innocence organizations, there'll be some from some states walking around who have gotten a decent or even sometimes large settlements and or restitution, and then others in exactly the same circumstances get nothing or at all. California has not been a particularly good on this, on that score. Other states are a little more generous or maybe the term is fair. I mean, someone has been exonerated from being incarcerated for a crime they didn't commit. Society seems that, should want that person to succeed and return to a productive life, and that takes resources.
It sure does. Let's go.
I agree with Scott's point.
New York, Mayat is with us. Hello, Mayat. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. Excellent show. I have my usual three-parter, and I'll listen over the air. First, Edward, thank you for your work, and I'd like to know how you came on her story and got involved. I'd like a bit more information about the trial. We have the year, but I'd like to know the length of the trial and what city in California and whether there were appeals. The second part and third part deals with your thoughts on public policy and philosophy. I recently heard someone who's doing activist in New York City who's working in New York State to have, I think it's a type of commission that would oversee prosecutors. There's no oversight on prosecutors. Oftentimes, they want a win. And sometimes, like in the Central Park 5 case, they actually knew the DNA didn't match. It was huge headlines in the New York Times about the DNA not matching. And, of course, our current president, he actually took full paid ads in the middle of a trial. And so, of course, they weren't asking for the death penalty in a rape case. She was brutalized but did recover. The third part deals with the sentencing project. I recently heard them, I believe it was NPR, and they have done a report. And what is so shocking is that other countries seem to factor in that when you have a huge criminal justice system, that a certain number of people are going to be wrongfully convicted. So what they do, like they mentioned Norway, where the maximum sentence is, I think it's 21 years around any type of murder, and I know it's hard, a hard concept to get one's head, but I want your comment on this type of retributive, punishing type of perspective, and society, and even our politics seem to be going in that direction. And if you have my questions, Edward, I'll listen over the air.
Okay. Well, you know what?
Lots there.
We'll show on those questions.
Lots but, there.
But real quickly, the first part, how did I get on this story? I was researching the work of the Innocence Project and not looking at any particular case, but just kind of interested in an insider's view of how that process works, because it performs such a unique service within our justice system. And that led me to discover the Parks case and use that as a focus to talk about some of these issues. A little bit more about the trial you wanted to know. The trial occurred in the city of Norwalk, California, which at the time was known by the lawyers who worked in the courthouse as Nowalk, because the jurors were so tough on crime there. And nobody walked out, basically. That trial was stretched out over almost a year of hearings, although with breaks in between. It wasn't like nonstop for a year. But it was a long trial and a lot of witnesses and a lot of information for the jury to absorb. Public policy questions about, you mentioned prosecutorial and law enforcement misconduct as and there being a lack of accountability. I agree that that has been a problem over time, not in this particular case, the Parks case, but in many other wrongful convictions. Conduct by the authorities has been less than we would hope for. A prosecutor's duty is not to win their cases. Their constitutional duty is to see that justice is done. And I think the system loses sight of that sometimes. In forensic testimony, the kind of thing that's issue in the Parks case and in many other false convictions, there was an initiative underway during the previous presidential administration, and it involved the Justice Department, law enforcement agencies, academics, the defense bar, and forensics experts themselves, trying to instill more scientific integrity into the use of scientific and forensic testimony in courtroom. And it was a huge initiative. It had been sparked by a report by the National Academy of Sciences on how poor our forensic sciences were in terms of having the research and data to back them up. That initiative was making progress, but it was scrapped by our current presidential administration. Right now, there is no systematic review of at the national level of the poor quality of our forensic sciences. So that is something that perhaps the states or professional organizations need to pick up that ball, because the federal government has dropped that ball.
Edward, and in her new trial that they're working on, they want to be able to point out what evidence is not good.
Yes. Well, and it centers around what we know about the behavior of fire today versus in 1989 when fire occurred. And that is that we understand better how flashover leaves a false trail that can appear suspicious.
And explain flashover, if you would.
Flashover occurs in a very, very hot, severe fire attacking a structure or a room in a structure. And what happens is the temperatures become so high that everything that is combustible in that room where eventually the entire house burst into flames. And it happens in a very explosive fashion. And so things that normally wouldn't, you know, a fire starts with something burning in a room. It's, you know, and then when flashover occurs, the room is literally on fire. It's not a fire in a room anymore. It's a room on fire. And it's a distinction that causes the ability for arson investigators to figure out what happened in a house fire. It degrades that ability. And the reason for that is that the secret of finding out how a small fire starts, one where the flashover isn't involved, is to find out where it started and how it spread and what could have caused the initial ignition when you find that point of origin. Once flashover occurs, there's so many sources of ventilation and of fires starting in different places in the room that it can become impossible or at best very difficult to determine where the true point of origin of a fire is and what caused it.
All right, let's go.
Without that information, it's almost impossible to say definitively how a fire started, and that the correct answer, many experts say, is to say it's undetermined. We just don't know, and it's a very hard thing for police investigators to admit that it's unknowable. They want to know.
They have to know.
Yeah. And well, but sometimes it's not possible. And then you have experts who come in and say, "No, we know anyway. Even though flashover occurred, we know it's a suspicious fire." There's just no science to back up that opinion, but they come in and say it anyway, and they're persuasive.
Let's go to Steve, truck driving in Michigan. Steven, go ahead, sir. You with us, Steve? Nope, he's not there. Let's go to Matt, truck driving in Ohio. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi, guys. I just had a quick question. Based on the conversation that we've had so far, I'm assuming that this is an electrical fire.
Yeah.
Okay. Now,
that was the theory, but that's not proven either.
Okay, because I was just wondering if there had ever been any investigation into the electrical hookup to see if it was, like, illegal or, you know, overextended on its power range or anything like that. And the reason I asked that is because, you know, there was a rather famous case in Westman, Michigan about 10 years ago, where a restaurant owner had illegal wiring hooked up on his box that started a fire that took down the cold corner of the strip mall that he owned. And he was brought up on charges and convicted of arson, basically, because he had hired his cousin to do the illegal wiring hooked up.
Well, I'm sure the wiring in this house was not code, was it, Edward?
It certainly wouldn't be today. The accusation was, for the first year of the investigation, the fire investigators said that a deliberately overloaded extension cord had been placed to start a fire. But then,
how many people would know that?
Yeah, well, here's the problem with that theory is that, so that was what they based their entire case on until they had an electrical engineer look at the wiring. He said, this didn't start any fire.
No.
There's no evidence.
And that was the basis for their entire case, wasn't it?
It was. So then they turned around and said, oh, okay, the wire didn't cause it. It must have been a failed incendiary device. And then she started the fire with a match right in the spot where that wire supposedly caused the fire. Now they say, oh, she must have started it by hand because there's no other way for the fire to have started.
Yes.
That's a approach that firefighters call negative corpus, where in the absence of evidence of how the fire started, they can say, oh, well, she must have started it with a match. That is literally what the state of the evidence became after the wire was shown not to have caused the fire.
It sounds like, for whatever reason, economics included, that she was probably negligent in the way she took care of the kids, but probably did so the best way she could with what she had.
I think that's a fair conclusion to draw, yeah.
Edward, we are out of time. Good luck. And when is her next trial? Is there a date set?
if the appeal is being filed
soon, I guess.
Soon, yeah, it has to be soon. So that is being prepared now.
Okay, good. We'll keep in touch and try to monitor that case. I'm very, very interested in that case right now. Up next, we're going to take a little break, but we're going to be back and talk about the miracle in the cave right here on Coast to Coast with our special guest, Southeast correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Liam Cochrane, joins us next.